I'm talking about actually what happened before this sutta, what led up to the sutta, sorry. So the Buddha stayed in the forest with the four monks who still had work to do. No, not this, because they all still had work to do. But with the four who hadn't yet come to realize anything. They maybe were impressed, but it still wasn't clear in their minds. So the Buddha spent the next four days with them in the forest. The first day, Kundanya went out for alms, and they all ate off of the food that he got. It was just from going through the village and people seeing a holy man and saying, "Sadhu, sadhu," and the sadhu would, the monk would come and receive the food that they wanted to give, because they had some kind of appreciation for such people. And and the rest of them would just live off of that food. Then the second day, one of the four ascetics became a sotapanna as well. And the third day, another one. And the fourth day, another one. And on the fifth day, which is 4 days after the first discourse. All four of them had become sotapanna. And so this is where we start here. Eva me sutang ekang samayang bhagava. So the first thing to talk about is what we mean by the word atta, and what we mean by the word self. This is before we start to talk about the actual parts of the sutta, we have to talk about the word self. And this is probably the one that people grapple with the most when they first come to practice the Buddha's teaching. And I think the obvious thing to point out here is that much of the grappling that goes on is because of our improper grasp of the Buddha's teaching. Or I think you can go even further and say our improper grasp of reality. And there's the simile of the knife. When you grasp the knife improperly, it cuts the hand. And the same thing goes with reality, really. Or with truth. I guess you could say with science might be a good word. With trying to understand, or with views. The problem we have with this is we approach it intellectually. And with a lot of cultural baggage and baggage that I think you really could call it cultural, but we'd call it scientific. So our entire way of looking at reality is based on some pretty heavy assumptions. Like the assumption that that things exist, right? That physical entities exist, and that the physical universe exists. and that the physical entities in the universe admit to laws and admit to investigation and theories properties that they have. And so what I'm trying to get at is that when we look at the idea of self, we think of it in terms of whether it exists or not, whether the self exists. And so we think of ourselves, and actually, just like people did in the Buddha's time, we think, well, what happened to me? If I have no self, then what am I, right? And this is, in many ways, it's really just cultural baggage talking, because it's our idea that we are something, or that there is this entity that is us. It's when we actually begin to practice, when we look at how the Buddha approaches this, he's not actually stating this, that the self exists or not. And it's not that because he never says that the self doesn't exist, that he somehow believes that the self does exist. It's just that his way of looking at the universe and looking at reality is not in that frame of mind. And I'm not sure if I'm explaining this quite well, but what I want to get across is that it's not just that the Buddha is being practical here, because he certainly is being practical. One thing you could say, if you wanted to go the easy route, you could just say, well, the Buddha is just being practical, and he's avoiding these metaphysical or these theoretical questions, and he's not even going there. But I think, as I talked about last time, and as I'd like to make clear, it actually goes further than that. That really, the Buddha's understanding of reality is experience first. All of the Buddha's teaching is trying to get us to understand reality from the point of view of experience, not from the point of view of entities that exist. Right? So not from the point of view of ourself or anyone else's self, or the world or the universe or God or any entity of any sort, even rocks and trees. So when we say, here I live in the forest and there's all these trees around me, the Buddha was trying to explain to us, as far as I understand, was trying to explain to us to come back, to turn this on its tail, and instead look at it from the point of view of first-person experience. And if you really want to understand non-self, you want to understand the Buddha's teaching in terms of modern science, and I'm not saying that you should, because if it's not interesting to you, or if it's not confusing to you, and if you think, yeah, well, non-self, okay, let's get practical, let's just practice meditation, then by all means, ignore it. You know, don't even think about what is the framework that the Buddha was talking about. Just practice. If practical appeals to you, let's be practical. That's the key. But for a lot of people, it's confusing, and because of their paradigm, because of the way they look at the world, it just makes no sense. You know, it confuses them. If this is the case, and if you really want some help, one thing I would recommend, and hopefully it's a beneficial thing, is to study quantum physics. Study orthodox quantum physics, just a little bit. There's a really good book called The Mindful Universe, and the author of it is just a brilliant fellow. I don't know how I stumbled upon it in a library in California, and then I found all of his articles on the internet. A professor named Henry Stapp, and he quotes a Buddhist monk in one of his, he quotes Nyanaponika Bhikkhu in one of his papers. And he's brilliant. He's well respected. He's an expert in his field. And the things he says really explain reality quite well, and I think are perfectly in line with what the Buddha says. If you study that a little bit, you'll come to see that actually three-dimensional reality is just a concept. It's a construct that is useful, and because we have it, we've been able to come up with lots of neat things. It's made it easy for our brains to comprehend reality, but it doesn't describe reality. Reality can only be understood as it relates to our experience. This is what orthodox, the original quantum theory, states. And there are people like Bohr and Heisenberg. And there are quotes that I posted on my profile. You can go read them. And so this is how I think we should understand this, that not only is it practical to do so, because it's immensely practical, and it's great to be free from the need to philosophize about whether there is a self or there is not a self, and whether the universe is deterministic or non-deterministic, and get right down to moment-to-moment experience. It's immensely practical, but I think it should be understood as beyond practical. It should be understood as reality, the truth. The truth is that there is no foothold you can gain. There's nothing you can cling to as saying this is true, that is true, the world is like this, the world is like that. The Buddha called this a thicket of views. It just leads you deeper and deeper in. You can never find this sure footing in terms of saying this entity is like that and that entity is like that, except in terms of moment-to-moment experience. So when we say that everything goes according to cause and effect, right? What this sounds like we're saying is that the universe is deterministic. It sounds like we're saying, well, there's no self. Then that means the universe is deterministic. But you see, the premise there is that the universe exists in the first place, and that there is this system of determinism. It's very difficult to understand, and as I said, it's not really necessary to understand, but just to kind of give an idea that the first thing we have to do, and the first thing that comes to us in meditation, the first thing that has to come to us for us to make progress, is for us to make this shift and stop thinking in terms of what is and what isn't, and just look at the relationships between things. And as you do this, like a knot, you untie it, you unravel this mystery that is reality, and you free yourself from all sorts of misunderstandings, all kinds of views and attachments. And eventually you unravel it until there's nothing left, until it's all what you thought was this self or this soul or this entity turns out to be insubstantial. So that's what we're going to do here, and that's what you'll see the Buddha doing. He's not even addressing the question of whether a self exists. As I said, he's addressing the experiences that these guys are having. You could say he's actually using this to bring the five bhikkhus around to this way of looking at things. So here they have this idea, is there a self, isn't there a self? And he said, well, look at it in a different way. When you experience rupa, this is the first one, rupang bhikkhave. He says, well, it's not self. Or it's unself, as some people like to say. Let's just say it's not self, right? Non-self, you can say, but non-self is really incomprehensible to me. It's not self. How is it not self? Well, it's not the owner, the sami. It's not the niwasi. It's not the inhabitant. It's not the actor, and it's not the experiencer. And why isn't it? He said, because if it were, rupancha hidang bhikkhave atta abhavisa nahidang rupang abadaya samvadaya. If it were self, atta abhavisa, if it will have been self, then it would not lead to affliction, abhadaya, which is illness or sickness, or affliction is a good word. What he's saying here is that if by whatever meaning of the word you use the word self, I guess especially here in terms of the owner or the actor, the owner, I think, if it belonged to us, then it shouldn't cause us suffering. When someone, if someone beats you up, for example, if you get hit with a stick. Well, if you were in control of the physical world, then this wouldn't happen. And if I was in control of the physical world, I would have perfect internet. But it's impermanent. Or it's, you're saying it's non-self. And you would be able to say, evang me rupang hotu, evang me rupang ma hosi. Let my form be thus, let my form not be thus. Basically, it's nonsensical to say that rupa is self, that form is self. If we say the body is self, well, in what way is it self? Is it the owner? No, it's not the owner. It's actually just experiences. It's not the inhabitant, it's not the doer. And it's not the experiencer. He's focusing here on the idea that we can't control it. Because if you could control it, you could stop from getting sick, for instance. You could be free from old age. You could be free from death. And he's really asserting this here. He's setting the stage. This isn't really the core argument. It's actually a form of debate here. In a debate, right? In a debate, you first set out your argument, or you set out your conclusion, your side, what you're going to argue, and then you start to debate it. So right now he's just setting out his conclusion, actually, saying it's not self. And he's saying, if it were, you know, these are very strong statements. Okay, the how is Rupa not the experiencer? They are experiences, and the self could be seen as the one who experiences them. Yes, but the Rupa doesn't experience. The form doesn't experience. Form is something that is experienced. And so we're just dealing with Rupa, actually. And I don't know if I want to get into so much explanation, because here he's not explaining anything. But what he is explaining is the fact that you can't control it. So if our view of self is that we can control it, right? We can control our body. We think when we walk, it's I who's walking. Right? We think it's under our control. But in fact, it's not really under our control. We might be able to, there might still be the idea that the mind is able to push buttons, right? And we lift our arm, we want to walk, then we walk. Right? So we might still think that the mind is self. At this point, we're just dealing with the physical, but we should really be able to agree that form is not self. There's an interesting story in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Majjhima Nikaya number 35. And Buddha gives an interesting simile here. This Satchaka, this ascetic, he comes to the Buddha and he says, I assert thus, material form is myself, feeling is myself, perception is myself, formations are myself, consciousness is myself. And the Buddha says, in that case, Agivesana, this is his clan name, I shall ask you a question in return, answer it as you choose. What do you think, Agivesana, would a head-anointed noble king exercise the power in his own realm to execute those who should be executed, to fine those who should be fined, and to banish those who should be banished? So he's asking, if someone is a king and is totally in control of his kingdom, does he have the power to banish this person or that person, and kill this person, kill that person? And Satchaka says, oh yes, for sure. And if he should be able to find anybody, he should be able to kill anybody, banish anybody. And then the Buddha says, well, then what do you say? When you say material form is self, do you exercise any such power over that material form as to say, let my form be thus? Evang me rupang hotu, evang me rupang maahusi. And at that he was silent. Because through accumulated behaviors and habits, we come to identify, or there arises the identification in the mind with the body, in this case. In the mind there arises a desire to move or to eat or to scratch or to do this or do that. And the body responds, and the mind and the body being a part of really of the same experience. So one experience leads to another, and leads to another, and there arises there is conditioned, moment to moment experience is conditioned in such a way as to have the idea of a self. But in fact, when you turn this on its tail, and you stop thinking in terms of the body, and you look at it in terms of moment to moment experience, you see that actually it's really just one experience leading to the next. And the idea that I am in control, we don't even know how it works. No one can explain how a desire to move leads to the movement in the body. Yeah, the beginning doesn't actually deal with all four types of belief in Atta. But when we get more into the mental side, then we'll understand those. We're right now dealing with Rupa. So yeah, Rupa, if you believe that Rupa is not self, then you can say, well, there could still be the inhabitant, and there could still be the experiencer. But we know that Rupa is not any of those four. We know it for two reasons. One, because Rupa is something that doesn't experience anything ever. And when the mind is gone, the Rupa remains. When someone dies, the Rupa remains, and you can be pretty sure there's nothing inhabiting it. Even people who believe in the self believe that it's left. It's probably not inhabiting the dead body, except in those rare cases where it comes back and animates, and you have zombies and so on. And there's no idea that there's the Vedika, there's the experiencer. When a person dies, everyone is pretty clear that there's no experience going on. Whether you believe in the self, don't believe in the self, whether you're a materialist or whether you believe in the existence of the mind as something distinguishable from the physical. When a person dies, well, the Rupa is still there, but none of these self are there. It's not owned by anyone, it's not inhabited by anyone, it's not acting. No, it's not acting. And it's not, well, let's say it's not the owner, it doesn't own anything, it's not inhabiting anything, it's not the actor, it's not acting, and it's not experiencing. So Rupa is not any of these four kinds of self. That's where we're at right now. Number two, Vedana Anatta. But really, the Buddha's just, he's just setting the stage here, and so he's hitting right to the point that you can't control it. You can't control the body to be free from illness. And you can't stop yourself. The story of Satchika is apparently especially interesting because Satchika was fairly ugly. If I remember correctly, there's the commentary says this. He was like a hunchback and he had warts and stuff. And he was physically unattractive. Like kind of disfigured, you could say. And so this is why the Buddha kind of hit upon this in the beginning. It may not have been Satchika, it may have been someone else. But anyway, it was at one point the Buddha asks this, and the commentary says, well, it's especially pertinent because he's not very attractive. Or it's not that he's not very attractive, he's apparently disfigured. And so if he could control it, then he could say, you know, let my form be something else. Let my form be thus, let my form not be thus. When I cough, let myself not cough. When I'm hungry, let myself not be hungry. See, I could. When I want to speak, let myself speak. I was cutting bamboo a week or two ago. Not cutting bamboo, there was a dead bamboo, and I wanted to take it, ironically, to make a pole for my internet. And so I broke it off, but as I was breaking it off, I cut my finger quite deeply. And now my middle finger doesn't work as well as it used to. It still works, but I think it's a good example. Suppose it had cut deeper, or suppose I had cut my finger off. It helps to shatter this idea. I mean, obviously you can sew it back on, or there are things that can be done. In a gross sense, you can control it. But it points to the fact that this is all in a very delicate web, and if that web is disrupted, there's no control, there's no going back. No, I don't think nerve damage, I don't know. It still works. But you could get, if you get nerve damage, I have a friend from youth who was the craziest of us all, the most daring, and he would do these extreme sport. He always led us in the extreme sports. And he was doing cross-country biking, and he would do these jumps, and so he took his last jump and landed flat on his back, broke his back, and now he's in a wheelchair. Talk about experiences of non-self, not being able to control. Because of the way the body and the mind work, however that is, because of the way experience goes, and there's the physical and the mental, or there's the appearance of these two things, we get this idea that we're in control, not realizing that it's just the way things are going, and that at any moment it could change in a totally different way. When your back breaks, it kind of shatters this theory that you're in control. You realize that it's all actually just causes and conditions, and with the right conditions, there will be a specific result. If the conditions change, then the results will change. I guess I should dive right in here, because really this is all just beating around the bush. When you practice meditation, this is where this really becomes important. This is really what we should be talking about. In meditation practice, you realize this. I mean, I can give examples of how people break their backs and so on. I think they're useful to kind of make us think and say, yeah, really it's not under our control. But I don't think it really gets to the core. When you practice meditation, you see the truth of anatta. And remember, this is what these guys had been doing for the past 6 years, and then the past 5 days they had actually been practicing correctly. But they had fairly well-trained minds, to say the least. And so they were able to watch moment to moment what was going on. When they moved their foot, they were able to see the foot moving. And if you do this enough and intensively enough, you actually do see that the mind isn't making the foot move. The mind that wants to move is preceding the foot moving. And at times, the body will be working on its own. Actually, at all times, the body is simply that which follows after a mind state, wanting to stand up, and then the standing arises. There is nothing by which you could say one is controlling the other. And this observation arises. You know, it's not an intellectual one, but it's visceral, I think is the word. It's obvious. You see it for yourself. One comes, then the other comes. Wanting to stand up, then standing up. Wanting to move and then moving. Wanting to sit and then sitting. The whole idea of control is just a theory. And so the mind perceives this. Anyone who's practiced intensive meditation will be able to tell you that at times they can see, without even trying really, but just by watching and by getting clearer picture of the way things are going, they will see that the body is not actually being controlled by the mind. What happens is the mind comes, then the body follows, and then there arises the perception that, yeah, I moved my hand, or yeah, I moved my foot, and that's due to the imprecise observation. And when you look closely and you watch the wanting, and you say to yourself, wanting, wanting, and then you move, moving. And if you do this enough, you're able to see, oh, first the mind arises, then the body arises. And the mind is, well, as we're going to see, as we're going to explain, the mind is not self either. And we'll try to give some reasons there, and specifically dealing with meditation. I think the best example of how the body is not self is the indeed, Stephen says, we identify with our actions. We do indeed. Studies confirm it. I hope you post some of those studies on the web blog. That would be interesting for all of us. If there's any studies that relate to our practice, or even what we're talking about here. But what I was going to say is the stomach. The rising and the falling, and I've talked about this before. Probably a lot, many of you have heard this. The reason why people don't like watching the stomach, and they're always trying to find a reason why they shouldn't. Well, it's many people say it's not what the Buddha taught, or it's not my cup of tea. It doesn't accord with my character type. I hear this one a lot. People get this idea that there are all these character types and you have to pick a meditation based on your character type, which is true if you're dealing with a concept. But why people don't like to practice the rising and the falling is because it's not very much fun, you know. Really, why is because you can't control it. To put a fine point on it, to sum it up, the reason why we don't like to focus on it is because we can't control it. If you focus on the breath, you can control the breath in the sense that you know it's coming in and you know it's coming out. And you focus only on that. You don't focus on the physical sensations because you can't control those. You focus on the breath, and the breath is controllable. Now in, now out, now in, now out, because it's a concept. It's permanent, no, it's stable. In is in, it doesn't change. Right? As long as you don't look at how it's going in and the way it's going in and how the body is reacting to it, then you're fine. Everything is controllable and stable and peaceful and happy. But when you focus on the stomach, suddenly you're in the realm of reality. You're focusing on the body. So sometimes it's long. I mean, think about it. We get this delusion, we think we can control the stomach as well. We think, okay, I'll do watch the rising and the falling of the stomach, and somehow I'll control it to be always the same. Right? So I'll get it really smooth, and if I get really good at this, the stomach will be really smooth. But it's like we throw all of our biology lessons out the window, because we're dealing with a physical system, and it's not just the stomach that we can take off of our body and control, right? We can't just, okay, here's my stomach, put it down and make it rise and make it fall. No, it's totally interconnected with the other systems in the body, and even biology can tell you that your stomach is not always going to rise and fall in the same way. And it doesn't, and because it doesn't, it's not pleasant. This would have been what the Buddha would have been teaching these five. This is what he taught in the first sutta. He started off the first noble truth, the five khandhas, and now he's coming back to them. This is probably what he was focusing on for the past 5 days. And so now he's saying, look at them, look at them, look at them, and teaching them how to look at the five aggregates. And now he's coming, he's going to ask them. First he's making statements. But here, the first one we have here is form, and as I said, I think the stomach is a good example. Let my stomach be thus, let my stomach not be thus. Let it be smooth, let it be comfortable. But it doesn't allow that. And why it doesn't allow that? It's not self. And so it leads to affliction. Even the stomach leads to affliction. It's uncomfortable, right? It's unpleasant. And the more you cling to it, thinking, I am in control, I am in control, I'm going to keep it smooth, the more you suffer. Right? That's number one. Number two, Vedana Anatta. Vedana means feelings. But here we're specifically talking about the bare experience, the bare experience of a phenomenon as being pleasant, painful, or neutral, with no judgment yet. There's the pleasant feeling, a feeling which is agreeable or leading to, has some sort of charge to it that is harmonious in a physical sense, I suppose. And then there's the suffering which is disharmonious, or I don't know what the word is, unharmonious, out of harmony with the, in the physical sense, and that's this, the painful feeling. And then there's the neutral feelings, which neither create harmony or destroy it. But you know, just as we understand, there's the painful, there's the pleasant, there's the neutral feeling. There are these three kinds of feelings. I think it's pretty clear as to how we differentiate between them. So what about Vedana? How does Vedana work? Is Vedana something that we can say, let my feelings be thus, let my feelings not be thus? No, it's certainly something that we cannot say. And here's the idea, someone gave this idea of transhumanism, where we could put our minds into robots and never have to experience feelings. And we wouldn't even have brains, we'd have these electronic brains that could just make us happy all the time. And really, either the conclusion is that you're going to do away with the mind entirely and make it just a robot that appear that can pass the Turing test, if you know what that is, but isn't conscious, or you're going to have a mind that's developing a lot of clinging. If there is a mind in there somehow, and you have only pleasant feelings, then really you're coming back to the second noble truth. You're having more clinging. You're building this expectation of physical pleasure. Either that, or you have no mind. Right? Either that, or it's just a deterministic system of physical realities. Because the mind is not. Mind is not self. And when the mind is not any of the four types of self, but feeling as well. You control it and control it and control it, and you build up these addictions really to the pleasant sensations. And eventually things have to change. You know, eventually could mean billions and billions and billions of years and eons into the future, but eventually it has to change. And this is what really the Buddha is going to drive home, that everything is impermanent. And because it's impermanent, it can't satisfy you. Even happy feelings, pleasant feelings, if somehow you could have a perpetual happiness machine that brought people happy feelings constantly. Those happy feelings are moment by moment by moment arising. They're not the same. They're not experienced the same. And the mind isn't a static entity. This is what I meant when I said the mind is not self in this regard, because the mind is not something that experiences each feeling the same. From moment to moment to moment, the pleasant feeling is experienced differently. And the mind that arises based on the previous feeling is different. Because mind is not self. Mind is something that arises and ceases. We're not there yet, but this is the problem with with feelings, that feelings can't lead to happiness, because there is no one who can experience the pleasant feeling permanently. The feeling leads to an experience of happiness. You know, the mind likes it. That mind leads to another mind, wants to experience the feeling. Feeling comes again, and so on and so on. And each mind conditions the previous mind. And so as a result of clinging to these happy feelings, it really sets one up for a lot of suffering. It doesn't satisfy, and it isn't. There's nothing that you could say about it as far as being good or bad, or being good in this sense. You know, what purpose is it to have a perpetual happiness machine? Unless it's permanent. See, but perpetual is not permanent. So we don't know what's going to happen next. Maybe the machine breaks. Maybe eventually things change. Unless there is something permanent. When we practice meditation, we come to see that none of it's permanent. The pleasant feeling, we say this perpetual pleasant feeling, is actually moment to moment. And it's changing moment to moment. Again, it comes back to this idea that of not looking at reality from a point of view of entities, right? The robot, the mind, the feeling, and so on. And looking at it in terms of the experience of the object. Because we think this is a robot that's constant, staying the same, and it's got these atoms and particles and injecting us with these chemicals or whatever, giving the mind some stimulus. But actually, that's not what we have at all. What we have is experience. You know, experience of pleasant feelings, reactions to the pleasant feelings, and a build-up. Anyway, it's all quite theoretical. In fact, in our ordinary... But this came up on our forum, so I thought I'd address it, or try to address it a little further here, because it's a good example. But in our ordinary everyday life, it's quite clear that we can't control feelings. We have pleasant feelings, regardless of whether it might one day be possible. You know, people have this theory that it could be possible to get there. We're not there. And we need something, we need some help. We need a way out, because we can't control our feelings. So the Buddha's pointing a way out here, really. As I said, it is quite practical. It's also the Buddha's understanding, our understanding of how the universe works, or the framework of the universe. But it's practical. He's as well. Most importantly, it's practical. He's helping us to let go. So he's saying, "Well, don't you see? Part of the problem is your misunderstanding. You're taking these feelings to be self." And they're not self. Why are they not? Because you can't control them. How do we know you can't control them? Because if you could control them, you wouldn't suffer. You'd be able to turn off unpleasant feelings. You'd be able to run away from them. What did the Buddha... somewhere the Buddha or one of the commentaries says it's like feelings should be considered like spears. Being stabbed with spears. That's how you should understand feelings. And you know, it's kind of a... something like that. It's kind of a sad way to... negative, pessimistic way to look at things. But if you take aside the pain part of it, this is really how feelings are. They come to us. And we don't give rise to a feeling, which is what we think. We think, "I feel." Right? Like as though we planted the feeling and it gave rise to some kind of fruit. Or we turned it on, right? Yeah, like you have this machine, you have your computer, and you push the button and it turns it on. We think of feelings like that, that they come from us. But actually they're like spirits. It's like someone stabbing you. The feeling comes to the mind. You'll be sitting there and suddenly the feeling comes. It has to do as well with us taking the body to be self. Because we take the body to be self, we think the feeling arose in me. But actually it arose based on the body, it's true. But the body is not self either. The body is actually just a part of experience. Another reason, of course, why we see that the Buddha hasn't got into yet, why we see that the body is not self and feelings are not self, is because they come and they go, they arise and they cease. This is what is really going to be the key to his argument. As I said, he's not really arguing yet. He's stating. He's making bold statements about these five aggregates, and then he's going to argue for them. Right? It's like when you write a paper, you first state your thesis. You don't start arguing right away and then come to a conclusion. You start out right. You say, this is what I'm going to argue for. It's a technique, and it really is quite powerful. You start with something that the audience might be doubting. So you want to challenge them with something, and then the doubt comes up, and then you address the doubts. So the Buddha said the same about feeling, that you can't force your feeling to be always pleasant. It's not possible, because feelings are only one moment. And they're a part of experience, which is cumulative. One experience leads to the next, so it can never be constant. Because it can never be constant, well, this is what his argument's going to be. I won't get ahead of us. So number three, sannya. Sannya is here translated as perception, but we had a discussion about this. Someone pointed out that actually the word perception is not correct. Perception is, I think, a misunderstanding of the word perception, which I think most of us have. Most of us understand this correctly, because we think of perception as being qualitative. But as I understand, according to the dictionary, perception is quantitative. In other words, you perceive something. When you perceive something, that means you experience it. It's not qualitative. It's not saying anything about how you perceive it. Right? So we always say, I perceive it to be good, or I perceive it to be this or to be that. Someone maybe can correct me, or you can look it up in the dictionary anyway. I looked it up a while ago. And as I understand, the word should be apperception, because apperception is the qualitative side. You perceive it to be this or to be that. Whereas perception is just means to understand something. So probably, anyway, it's often also translated as memory recognition, which I think is a good one. Let's put a note here. Also, oh no, I think people will often use memory slash perception. But I think memory and recognition are really point to it. There's an interesting thing about sannya, just to get off on a little bit of a tangent, but certainly not a tangent from the point of view of our meditation. The Abhidhamma says that the root cause, or that which brings about mindfulness, that which brings about sati, with this word that we translate as mindfulness, is something called tira sannya. Tira means strong or firm, and sannya is this word that we have in front of us. And so in this sense, the word recognition is really a very powerful word to use to translate sannya. It really sets it up for our meditation practice. And Sorry, just a second. I realized I... just a second. Well, I'm sorry, it's not going to let me record this one. I'm going to figure out what's wrong, but I can't record. So there's no recording of this session. Fortunately. So we're dealing with recognition. This is the ability for us to recognize something, or the ability to relate one thing to another thing. The arising of one thought based on another thought, really. A thought based on an experience. So when you hear something, the arising of a thought. Oh, nice, thank you. That's it, I just get someone else to record it. Ah, yeah, wonderful. Someone who's out there thinking. They can send me the file afterwards. I should get a few people recording it just to make sure. Okay. So the, but sorry, what I was saying about tirasanya actually, when you have a firm or a strong recognition, when you recognize something clearly for what it is, there arises what we call mindfulness or sati. And this is according to the Abhidhamma. This is really the core doctrine here. Now, if you believe the Abhidhamma to be core doctrine. And it helps us to understand what we mean by mindfulness. Mindfulness means to recognize something for what it is, which, you know, sounds kind of mundane, but when we put tira in there, no, when we use the word tira sanya, what we really mean is to really know something for what it is, and to have a clear knowledge of something for what it is. There's an element of firmness and stability there, which is of course backed up by concentration and effort, and all sorts of wholesome mind states. But that's really what it is. It's the strong recognition. The recognition which is free from anything but the recognition. This is the word patisati. When we have in the Satipatthana Sutta, patisati mataya. To know something just and specifically for what it is. So that, a little bit of a tangent, but that helps us to understand what we mean by sanya. It's that what it actually can lead to sati if it's strong enough. It's the strong recognition that leads to sati. But this refers to our memories and our recognitions, which come based on... Actually, pairing these two up helps us to understand how it's not self. Because we think of memories as being self. I remember things. These are my memories, no? And this is me, some in time in the past, remembering how I used to be. Oh, those clever things I did, or oh, those stupid things I did, right? And we think of it as me and mine. We even think of the bad ones as me and mine. The idea that we're not... Actually, the idea that they lead to affliction isn't particularly strong enough to take this away, because we think of the bad ones as being self as well, right? Oh, I did something really stupid, no? Or maybe we're very angry at someone. Maybe we have trauma. This is one of the very important things to talk about for people who have trauma. When I first meditated, the people who were teaching me, I mentioned this last week, I think, I'm really dissing these people. Hope they're not here. But they had this idea that I should I was repressing something, and wanted to help me bring this up, because you have to deal with what you're repressing, right? And we do this in therapy as well. So it's the idea is to relive those experiences, relive those memories. And there are actually people out there who claim that it works, that when you relive it, it somehow cures the problem. I've never found this to work, and I've talked to people who have done this. When they come to practice meditation, they've done this already. They've tried this. And yeah, it may have given them some kind of confidence that they didn't have. But it doesn't do away with the identification with the memory. It, in fact, in many ways, reaffirms the self, or can reaffirm the self. And so what I always tell people, and what I think is really the most useful thing, is to not worry about the memories, bad past memories and trauma that we've had. They're not the most important, and they're not intrinsic to our emotional state. The only reason that they are related to our emotional state is because we keep going back to them. So we think that somehow they have, I'm an emotional mess because of something in the past. And so they try to find a way to fix this. Right? And, well, and they keep going back to these memories again and again, and that reaffirms it. Teaching people that they should go back to those, it has the, seems to have the effect of, well, in many ways reaffirming the attachment to them. By teaching people to focus on the emotions, and when the memories come up, to look at them, but to look at them just as memories, and to not worry about the connection between the two, but just see them for what they are. What seems to occur is that we're able to break this idea of those past memories as being something bad, as we're able to experience the memories without clinging to them, without attaching to them, right? Because we're able to see that the memories arise and cease. Actually, the memory is not something that exists in the past, it's something that arises here in the present. Seeing that they arise and they cease, and most importantly, seeing that they arise of their own, they arise based on causes and conditions. So you, for a person who has a very strong memory, it's something that has conditioned a very strong response, or it's something that has this strong echo, in that many mind states will arise based on it. So you'll think about it. What it means is you'll think about it again and again. For these people, almost anything will trigger this. You'll hear a sound and it reminds you right away of the trauma. It can be quite strong for people who have strong trauma. When you look at this, you start to see the relationship. You see, oh, actually, you know, this is really nothing to do with me. It's, before it was a horrifying thing. Oh, how terrible. Now you see, oh, how ridiculous, really. See this, it reminds me of that. See that, reminds me of this. People often take their dreams to mean things. And I think dreams are interesting, and in a way they might help us to overcome the idea of having just this one life, depending on how you look at them. It obviously there are many interpretations that... But some of the interesting things that we experience in our dreams really have nothing to do with this life, and they're not memories of this life. So many people, I mean, obviously it's highly contentious, but if you're into these kind of things, it is kind of neat to think that these are quite possibly memories from past lives, or memories from some more universal or far-reaching sort of stream of experience, or stream of, or database, I guess you should. But in the end, that all they are is the arising of recognition, the arising of sannya, the arising of one experience based on another. Right? Because sometimes when a person is sleeping, and you know this trick where you put their hand in a glass of warm water and then they wet themselves. Right? Or you start talking to them in their sleep and they start having weird dreams. This is how our minds work. They give rise to recognitions of things. And the important point here that the Buddha's coming to is that there's something quite problematic about this. It doesn't go according to our wishes. You can't only remember the good things. And it's not really you remembering the bad things. If it was, then you could control it. Why would you remember bad things, right? If it was really you remembering them, why wouldn't you just stop? That's what the Buddha is saying. It's quite apt. Obviously, it's quite apt. This is the Buddha, no. But for those of you who are not familiar with the Buddha's omniscience or incredible brilliance, this should be a taste of it. But yeah, this Buddha really did know what he was talking about. It might seem kind of simple to people, but on the other hand, we should understand this is meditation. It's not a theory. What the Buddha is saying is that this is what he's experienced. We can say, yeah, I agree with that. It's logical. But until we experience it, we're not really understanding what the Buddha is saying. So these monks, they would sit down and they would remember this and they would remember that, and they would see, yeah, it's really not subject to our control. I don't want to think about this, I think about this. I want to think about this, I can't think about this. It's totally based on causes and conditions. If those causes don't arise, this is especially true and clear in meditation, because you're practicing a repetitive task, right? You're walking back and forth, or you're sitting and watching the stomach. And this breaks up our ordinary routine. Right? We don't have the stimulus, the enjoyable stimuli that we normally would have. And we aren't able to avoid the bad ones. So it breaks up our routine and allows us to see things on a more microscopic level. Because we'll see our old habits arising in meditation. Or we'll see our desires arising. And then we'll say to ourselves, no, I don't want that yet. I'm meditating. And the desire will come again, and we think, what the heck? Didn't I just say I don't want this? I'm meditating. But then it comes again. And then we begin to see that, hey, it's really not me that wants these things. It's just the habit that I built up. Right? It's funny. It's kind of like right on schedule, something comes up. And why? Because every day you've done that, or you've built up that attachment to this thing or that thing. So you'd be sitting in meditation, there it comes again. Before, you would have thought, yeah, I want to do this. Now you start to think, where is this coming from? This is relating especially to number 4. Let's get ahead, jump right ahead, try to finish up here. Sankhara. Sankhara is our desires. Not just our desires, but that's where the desires come in. Desires are a part of sankhara. Sankhara means formations. Here he uses the word determinations. No, why would you use determinations? I don't know where he got the word determinations from. I'm sure he has a brilliant reason for using it. But that's not what sankhara means. Sankhara means formation. It's got to be the best word because it fits all cases. Sankhara means something that is composed or something that has to do with composition. Something that is involved with the process of composition, of creating, or of forming. But I've translated it before as thoughts. In this context, so the word sankhara means formations. But the reason why I use the word thoughts is just not to translate it, but to explain it. Sankhara means formations, and so our body is a sankhara. Trees are sankharas, rocks are sankharas. Anything that is formed is a sankhara. It arises like that. It's put together like that. When you build a house, that's a sankhara. You've created something. It's been formed. And in this instance, the Buddha is using a specific meaning of the word sankhara. He's not talking about all of those types of sankhara. It's the same word, but a different meaning. So when he said sabbe sankhara anicca, all sankharas are impermanent, he wasn't talking about not specifically this type of sankhara. This is referring to mental formations. It's a formation that you make based on a recognition, for example. When you recognize something, what do? You form a opinion or a thought. And so what I meant by translating this as thought, it means what you think about something. Like if I show you something that I think is beautiful and I say, what do you think of this? Is exactly what we mean here. It's the state of mind that is formed based, or as we say, you form an opinion, right? It's exactly what we mean here, is the forming of an opinion or the forming of anything based on the previous thing. In this case, based on a previous mind state. So you see something. You recognize that as a person. And you recognize it more maybe as your wife or your husband, or you recognize it as your mother or your father or your son or your daughter or so on, your friend or this or that. That's all in the realm of sanya. Maybe you feel happy or unhappy. That's in the realm of vedana. But sankhara is when you see your husband or you see your wife or so on and you think, boy, I love my husband, I love my wife. Or maybe, boy, I hate my husband, boy, I hate my wife. Once you see it, you judge it. Another good way of understanding this is judgments. I mean, it can be as simple as when the stomach rises. When you know this is rising, that's sanya. When you say to yourself, rising, that's tirasanya. When your mind is firmly cognizant that this is rising. But when you say to yourself, it's rising long, or you say to yourself, it's rising short, or you say to yourself, it's deep, or you say to yourself, it's smooth, comfortable, uncomfortable, good, bad, me, mine, this is all sankhara. Conceptual formations, yeah. Whatever you want to put before the word formations. The word is formations. It's just important that we understand what we mean by formations in this sense. The use of the word formation is... Let's put a note here so that when people come they can see it. really means formations. It's not really clear what that's... Oh yeah, it is. Okay. Okay. Now, why are these not self? And this is what we really think of self, right? I like this. I like that. I don't like this. I don't like that. And this is what is really makes a person. What makes me different from you, as most people understand it, is my likes and my dislikes, my emotions, my thoughts, my views, my opinions, my mental formations. But the word formations really gives it away. Why is it not restricted to volitional formations? Because not all sankhara, I might be wrong, I have to think about that, but not all sankhara are volitional. That's a misunderstanding. Sankharas include all of the 52 jetasika besides sanya and vedana. Let me see if I can get this right. I think there's 52 jetasika. I hope I'm not miscounting them. And so 50 of them, would that make 50 of them are sankharas? Simply, all of the various types of minds that can arise based on something. Simply knowing that someone is tall. Right? When I look at two people and I say, that person's tall. Or when I look at someone and I say, that person's tall, or I say, that person's short. There's nothing in the person that says they're tall. And there's no recognition that... The recognition of tall doesn't exist. You don't recognize someone as being tall, but because of all of your memory, because of the recognitions of this person and that person, are shorter than this person. Therefore, there arises the thought that this person is tall. We conceive the person to be tall, but that's not volitional. Here we are referring to what is not self. This intention is the key. I don't know that I quite agree. Intention is important. Obviously, it's the most important. The sankhara is the most important in that sense because it includes intention. But I would argue, and I hope I'm not wrong on this, that part of sankhara is not really intentional or volitional. And you know, it's just as interesting to know that our conception of things is also not self. All of our thoughts. When you think, boy, that person's tall. Or, when you are able to recognize and able to put something together, for example. I suppose it also has to do with inventing things or when a person composes a piece of music or so on. All of these things can be construed as being self. Right? You can, when you have an interesting thought, right? when someone starts talking and you say, well, that means this or this or this, or you say, well, I believe. I suppose the key is that all of our views fit into sankhara. The view of self is a sankhara. That's really the key here. When you recognize something, like you look at your hand and you see your hand and you say, this is my hand. The conception that this is mine, it's not an intention, it's not volitional, but it's a formation. It doesn't exist in the hand itself. It's something that arises, and in this case it's a bad one. It's the view of self. But it need not be ethically potent. It can be that you recognize something, or you think of something as being this or that. The mere recognition that this is my hand, you say, okay, you see your hand, this is a hand, right? And then you think to yourself, it's my hand. That can be quite useful, actually. Maybe not specifically for your hand, but for many things, right? You have, when you go to the store, park your car, go into the store, you come back, remembering which one is your car is a useful thing. That's right, exactly. Identifying the formation as self is the problem. It's the problem with all of these things. I think it comes out clearly, as I was saying, in regards to invention or views or opinions. Right? People think very highly of themselves. Well, I believe, right? We always say, well, I believe. It's quite funny as a Buddhist to hear this, because we're like, yeah, so you believe? Big deal. And because people cling to this, they become proud of themselves. And thank you, Drew. I appreciate that comment. I hope in a good way. I could be I could be going too far here in a theoretical sense. I hope I'm not. But let's reiterate that the idea here is in a way to blow our minds, insofar as I'm not saying I'm hoping I'm successful, but I'm not saying that I'm successful in this. The idea is to blow our minds in terms of our understanding that there exists a three-dimensional universe or a universe which will support our views of self, for example, and come to look at things in terms of just experiences. So we can come to see that actually what's going on is things are arising and ceasing. Experiences are coming and going one by one by one. That is reality. There's nothing beyond that. This is what we're trying to effect here. And that's the way, that should be the direction that this takes. Hopefully that's taking us in that direction. That's the theory. It's not only a neat theory, but it's the most incredibly practical theory you could possibly come across. It's the best view, the most practical view you could ever have. It has purpose. It has meaning. It has benefit. Before we even attempt to answer whether it's true or not, it changes everything about how you look at the universe. Formations are any mental construct that arises based on an experience. Could be any mental construct. I think actually, you know, that this is just my interpretation or my understanding, because I think technically speaking, it goes a little deeper than that. And sankharas are just, as I said, the 50 jetasika. So it's things like one single pointedness of mind is a sankhara. I forget all my jetasikas. Attention, I think, is one. There's a lot of sati, mindfulness. Mindfulness is a sankhara, so there you go. It's not all bad ones. It's not all judgments. Mindfulness, which really is an absence of intention, in a sense. I'm not sure if I'm correct in that. It's actually probably ethically positive to be mindful. But in a sense, mindfulness is the absence of intention. Because rather than experiencing something and then saying, I'm going to do this, or this means this, or that means that, it's just saying, this is this. This means itself. It means exactly, it's a one-to-one relationship. And according to the Abhidhamma, what that does is it neutralizes the karma. So at the moment of the deciding mind, where you'd normally decide, you know, you experience something and there's the way the mind goes one after another, there comes to the moment where the mind is going to decide. Good, bad, me, mine, you, yours, what? And you say, it. Instead of saying what it is, you say, it. It is it. That's what mindfulness is. And that totally neutralizes it as well. Well, nothing. So then the javana arise, these seven minds that would be karmically potent, and they're karmically impotent. They don't have any result. Or I don't know, maybe they have some result that could be said to be the result that comes from being mindful. But in the end, I mean, an arahant has no intentions. An enlightened being has no karma. They cannot give rise to an intentional act. According to the Abhidhamma, it's impossible, as I understand it, for an arahant to give rise to an intentional act. Interesting, no? Their actions are functional. You might even say habitual, but they're just going with the flow. Okay, so hopefully that's number four. Have I gotten there? Why is this not self? Because we can't control it. Did I talk about this already? We think that we're in control of our thoughts. Right? What we think about things, I like this, I like that. But here, right, this is what I was talking about before we got to sankhara. We'll be sitting in meditation and the same likes that we thought were us come. And then come again, and we're like, no, not yet. And they come again, and they come again. And they overwhelm us. Our dislikes, we think, I dislike this. Well, what does it mean to say, I dislike it? Experience the same thing over and over again. Pain. Yes, I dislike pain, so that's why I move. That's why I massage. That's why I practice yoga. That's why I this, that's why I that. I'm not saying that's why people practice yoga, but some people practice yoga for that reason. But now in meditation, we have the same pain, but we don't do anything. We're told to watch the pain. Some people in the beginning, they think by saying pain, 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 oh, that means that's what's going to make the pain go away. Good, very clever. Like it. Easy. Just remember that. Every time I have pain, I'll say pain, 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 and it'll go away. Nope. We've already been through that. Pain isn't self. If it were, we could make it go away. Since we can't, it's not self. And since it's not self, we can't make it go away. But our dislike for the pain is the same, because we can't make that go away. Now we have to focus on it. The pain comes, disliking. Disliking, disliking. Focus on the disliking. Look at it. Oh yes, this is useless. Goes away. And it comes back. And eventually it's like, well, the pain's not really, you know, we start to feel like, well, the pain's not really a problem, but what's up with all this disliking? Where is this coming from? It becomes more important. Right? Before it was like, the pain's important. What do we do? Dislike it. Get rid of it. Now we start to see, well, actually, the pain's not really, you know, it really isn't that big of a deal. But holy crap, this disliking is a big deal. More and more and more, again and again and again, until we feel like, man, I'm a terrible person. Meditators often come to this. They think, I'm just a horrible, horrible human being with all this anger and hate inside of me. And then we come to see that these are not self at all. More importantly, we come to see that there are certain behaviors that were creating this. And by seeing those, we cease those behaviors. Or that we were perpetuating this. This is being perpetuated. And in seeing that, they go away. This is number four. Number five, consciousness. Consciousness is really the big one. It's what we think of being. This is where we would go if we scroll back up here. We'll see the inhabitant, Niwasi. So the consciousness is the inhabitant, no? Maybe it's the actor. Well, that would probably be Sankara, but we've realized that Sankaras are actually just formations, as the word says. They aren't really acting at all. Vedaka, it's not... Yes, Vedaka. We also think it's the experiencer. We think consciousness is the observer. Actually, it's not. It's none of these things. Consciousness is only able to observe one phenomenon and then cease. This is an observation in line with reality. It's very difficult to understand. When we haven't practiced meditation, we think of the mind as jumping, right? It's like this guy in the control tower, jumping from one computer to the next. This plane's coming, that plane's coming, directing all the traffic. Here's the mind jumping to the eyes, jumping to the ears, jumping, 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 moving. We think we conceive of the mind as moving to the object. Once we begin to practice meditation, that sort of an entity isn't found. This is important. Realize this, that when you practice meditation, you're not seeing this. We should reaffirm this. That no, in fact, we're not realizing this. Even because you can practice meditation, practice a lot of meditation, and still hold on to this idea that there's something observing. But ask yourself, have you found it? Is it there? Is it a part of the experience? What is really existing in those moments? When you get an answer to this question, you'll understand what is consciousness. Consciousness is a moment. It is that knowing that arises. When you move your hand, there's a knowing of the hand moving. When you move your foot, we always ask people when they're doing walking meditation, when your foot moves, do you know the foot is moving? Well, the knowing arises when the foot moves, and it ceases when the foot stops moving. That's what's really going on. It's very difficult to see. You have to practice quite intensively, but eventually you can see the mind, the consciousness arising and ceasing, arising with the object, ceasing with the object. So even though we're watching this, we say that we're watching this, we're not actually able to watch it, because our awareness is actually cut off from one moment to the next. Sometimes you'll be watching the stomach, for example, and then a whole different thought comes, totally unrelated. And you realize that the consciousness of watching the stomach was cut off. It didn't continue, it didn't jump. It's just gone. And you see this again and again and again. It's gone, it's gone, it's gone. Realization that everything... Yang kinchi samudaya dhammang sabantang nirodha dhammang. Whatever arises, ceases. This is what we learned in the last sutta. Well, we didn't learn, but this is what Kondanya learned in the last sutta. But we're not there yet, actually. I'm skipping ahead into the impermanent side. What does the Buddha say? Well, his opening argument really isn't, as I said, it's in regards to affliction. So can you say that, let me let me only experience this, let me not experience that? I mean, consciousness is in all of these things. In an experience of rupa, there's consciousness. In an experience of vedana, there's consciousness. In an experience of sannya, there's consciousness. Consciousness is in every experience. So it follows that if consciousness were this observer in the control tower, it follows that we should not have to experience bad things, right? Why would you experience something bad? Why would you see nasty things or listen? What if when someone was yelling at you, you could just stop? I'm not hearing you. Can you do that? What about when you have pain? Can you say, I'm not experiencing this pain. No more. You can't do it. More importantly, in meditation. In meditation, you see that it flits from object to object to object. Let my consciousness stay with the foot. Now, when I walk, I want my consciousness to be with the foot. Right. When I sit, let my consciousness be with my breath. Why do we have the impression that the self and the universe exist for more than one instant? If consciousness exists only for that instant and then totally disappears, what is left to create the delusion of existing in more than one instant? The speed of it. It's our inability to imprecision. Like when you look at a light, you know, why is film footage 30 frames per second in America and 25 frames approximately per second in Europe? Does anyone know the answer? Probably many of you do. I'll just give you the answer. The answer is because that's the rate at which light flickers. In those countries, because in Europe it's 50 hertz and in America it's 60 hertz. So in order to avoid flicker in your film, you have to set the frame rate accordingly, or had to. I believe it's not applicable in digital footage, I'm not sure. But the point being that when you look at the light, it looks like it's constant. Why? Because it's going really fast. And as a result, you can't tell that it's actually arising and ceasing. So if anyone were to try to tell you that the light arises and ceases, it would seem, well, that's not how I experience it. But it's simply because we can't see it quick enough. If you practice meditation, you won't see the light flickering, that's not the point. But you will see quick enough to be able to break it into pieces. It will break into pieces by itself, but that takes very specific and dedicated meditation practice. You're talking as if there is something seeing all these instants succeeding each other. What would that be? Yeah, it's really just a manner of speaking, I suppose, because that's, you know, how else am I going to talk? See, I'm even using the word I now. But if we're to get technical, it's just one mind arising after another, you know, and the minds arise in succession. I mean, this isn't theory. Again, the way you're looking at it is in terms of something being out there. You know, and of course, this is because we've been taught about self. The reality doesn't admit of this type of observation or this type of thinking in terms of the observer, something that observes it. Reality is experience. It's a moment-to-moment experience. And those experiences are not self. They arise one after another. What else could there be? Where could this observer be? What would it be doing? It's just a thought that arises. One thought comes after another. One thought follows the one before it. That's all you can say. If you want to come up with a theory that somehow they're related or somehow they're connected or somehow they're the same thing, then that's just a theory that arises in your mind. The reality of it is that one thought follows the next. So when you say one mind believes it existed before, that's one mind arising. Some minds believe that, some minds don't believe that. Why does it have memory of the previous existence? Well, some minds arise thinking of a previous existence, a previous instant. Some minds don't. But that's just one moment of a mind that arises thinking, I existed before, or thinking, I remember that, or thinking this, or thinking that. You can come up with whatever theory, but this is what I'm trying to point out here with this paradigm shift that needs to occur from these views and these actually sankharas, making these formations, making the connections in the mind, to actually seeing things as they are, seeing what really exists. Because it's those sankharas that have led us to suffering, or have led to the arising of suffering. You see, when you think about it and you start to develop views based on it, then it doesn't really make much sense, because it doesn't admit of views. Views just complicate things. They create complexity, unnecessary complexity. This is really what the whole idea of the non-self doctrine is to give up views. Not to come to the view that I have no self or there is no self. But it's, that's not such a dangerous view to have. A dangerous view is to believe that there is a self. You're adding complexity. You're adding something that it doesn't admit to verification. It's only some kind of logical reasoning. It's not experiential. It's not empirical. We're talking hardcore here. I think that's why it will blow the mind, and it really should. In fact, obviously what we have to say is that most of this is not going to be comprehensible if you're not meditating. And if you're not meditating based on these realities. If you're meditating based on a concept, or people who do transcendental meditation, it still might not be comprehensible. But when you focus on these things, just focus on the stomach for a while. Focus on the stomach rising and falling. You'll see all of this. Everything I'm talking about, you'll see. It's like taking medicine. The stomach is wonderful. It's like this pill. The red pill, right? Stomach is the red pill. You take the pill, and it's just one medicine. It's got, and it's very powerful. Is this right view? Most certainly it is. And the only thing I'd like to say on that is, I mean, most certainly it is. What I mean to say is, in a Buddhist context, yes, it is. So, yeah, it is. But, you know, there's obviously people out there who think it's wrong view. Our understanding is that it's right view. But what I'd like to say is that, I've said it before, I think, right view in a Buddhist context is often just giving up of wrong view. Giving up of views, because the word views, the Buddha most often talks about as being wrong, and synonymous with being wrong. And there's a point there. I think it's the point I'm trying to make, is that we're ultimately trying to give up views, because the Buddha's view is just really there's just the giving up. Right, it's the Four Noble Truths. What is the First Noble Truth? This is not going to satisfy you. What's the Second Noble Truth? Giving up your clinging to it. Third Noble Truth, cessation. Fourth Noble Truth, the way out of, or the way to cessation. It's really not taking on a view at all. So I think we can stop there. We got through all five aggregates. The internet started playing nicely finally. And someone was recording it all, Linda. So please, please don't run away. If you can find some way to get me that recording, that would be great. Then I can put it on my audio feed. I understand that there are some branches of Buddhism that think that consciousness or awareness does survive from one life to another. What do you think of this? I think it's contrary to what the Buddha taught. It also doesn't admit of investigation. Such a thing can never be verified. Not from a radically phenomenological point of view. Meaning, not from direct first-person experience. And in that sense, it has no meaning to the type of Buddhism that I am proposing or talking about or explaining. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people who do a lot of things. Buddhism is quite broad. I don't believe in one life or another. I've talked about this before. The idea of one life to another is an illusion. The idea of death is an illusion. Death is just a concept. True death is moment to moment. We're born and die in a single moment. The idea that something survives even from one moment to the next is really unverifiable. Unprovable. That's okay. Thank you, Linda. You can, as long as you can record, that's great. I can always cut it up anyway, or I can cut stuff off the end, but this is all good. We've been going. Some of you have been very patient. Welcome, Joe Cummings. Thank you for joining us. Joe, I don't know if he's actually here listening, but I assume he is. Joe is the reason, one of the reasons why I ended up following this type of Buddhism. I was on my way to China. I was in Chiang Mai, and I had a ticket to go to Kunming, I think. I can't remember now. To China, anyway. And then I was reading through the Lonely Planet guidebook that he wrote, or he was in charge of, I guess, which he wrote. And there was this little blurb about my teacher and his monastery, and so I chickened out, cashed in my ticket, and got on a bus and headed off to Wat Phat Si Jam Thong, where I ended up ordaining and learning so much. And he's publishing an article I wrote about how much I don't want to go back to Thailand. So if there are any questions, please, I'm happy to take them. This is a difficult one, really. You have to consider that these five bhikkhus were there. No? They were at the end of this sutta, we're going to see they became arahant. So they were really on a level that none of us really, well, I guess I shouldn't speak, no? That most of us are not. We're still working our way up there. But these guys were really there. If you're, especially newcomers, this is actually quite a difficult one to follow. And it's getting very deep in the meditation. It's not hard to understand. There's only five things that the Buddha's talking about. And the concept of non-self is actually easy to understand, but to understand its truth and to verify the truth of it is incredibly difficult. Even just doing a little bit of meditation won't give it to you. You really have to dedicate yourself to introspection and observation and objectivity. So thanks everyone for putting up with that. I hope I've done it justice on this, our first day dealing with it. Obviously I'm not going to be perfect, but hopefully it was of some use. I think it was. And kind of reaffirms in my mind that this is a good thing, this study group. So I think we're doing a good thing here. It's great. 17, 18 of us. Well, some of you are here twice. But quite a good group. I see it in the meditation, but the outside world reinforces the self. It doesn't have to. But yeah, it tries to convince you. Tries to convince you. But it's neat. You can approach any situation from the point of view of non-self, and you have ultimate, phenomenal cosmic power. Ultimate power. Omnipotence. It's funny, no? Non-self gives you omnipotence. What it means is there's nothing, there's no situation that could knock you off your block, that could knock you even out of stride, even the slightest, with the awareness of non-self in every situation. And it doesn't have to be something profound and hard to reach. It's just right now. Right now, look and see what you're clinging to. The only reason you're suffering is because you're clinging to it. You think, this is me, this is mine, this I am. All you have to do is right now, stop worrying, stop all of that, and see it as what it is. Once you can do that, walking is walking. Give up all your views and ideas about self and soul. Nothing can hurt you. I mean, the cynic would say, or sarcastic would say, it's because there's no you to hurt. And that's, you know, that's a theory. But I think that misses the point, to say the reason why you can't be hurt is because there's no you to hurt. It really misses the point. It goes too far, and it starts developing a view. Yes, there is no self. Sure, you can say it. The Buddha didn't ever say it, I don't think. It doesn't mean that he believed in a self, and he certainly didn't. He looked at the world totally different, in a way that doesn't admit of such views. Just moment-to-moment experience arising and ceasing. Anicca vata sanghara upadvaya dhammino upajitva niruchanti tesang vupasamo sukho. Indeed, all formations are impermanent, of the nature to arise and cease. Having arisen, they fade away. The stilling of all of these is true peace, true happiness. So with that, I guess we'll end for tonight. And see you all next week. Same time, same place. And hopefully see some of you tomorrow, because if the internet works, we'll be having a video session tomorrow with no ads. If it works as planned, which is a big if, we'll be using a new video solution that is hosted by sirimangalo.org and has no advertisements. Yeah, so I'll see whatever has arisen based on the you that is here and now. I will see that, or the I that exists at that time tomorrow will see the you that exists at that time tomorrow. 2 p.m. UTC, which 2 p.m. UTC tomorrow.